I'm your host, Jeff Dawson, for another episode of Dawson's Domain, where we cover the spectrum of life's pressing issues and events, from politics to relationships, sports to horror, alternative history to poetry, humor to baseball coaching, and everything in between. After technical difficulties again, now, I apologize for being late, but we just could not get a connection. It's been a little dicey down here in Dallas, Texas, which is much nicer today. The sun is out, the wind is blowing, and this ice and snow is starting to melt, which was, y'all seen it on the news. It was worse than what they could depict. It really was an ice box, but I lived here in 83, 84 when we had 13 days of this stuff and it was frozen all the way to Houston because my wife and I went to the Blue Bonnet Bowl, OSU and Baylor played, and that was absolutely miserable. And that's a whole different topic of why this happened. And of course, you're seeing everybody pointing fingers. Well, as far as I'm concerned, and I have a YouTube channel, Director 59, of where I just pretty well light up ERCOT, the Texas legislature, the utility commission, and the governor. They were all responsible for this. None of them are getting a pass. This was just a utter fiasco on an epic scale. We didn't have this problem in 83, 84, but then we also didn't rely on wind or solar. So that's something to think about. And then we also had one of these storms in 2011 when Jerry Jones opened up Jerry World and had the Super Bowl, the Packers and the Steelers. We got 12 inches of snow. We didn't have power outages like this. And here we are 10 years later, and it's an utter disaster. So you tell me, they want to investigate? Well, let's go back 10 years and see what happened. Now, today I am going to have a guest. His name is Robert Smith. We're going to be discussing a book by Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules of Life, an antidote for chaos, because there seems to be just a hell of a lot of chaos going on right now. And Robert, if you're listening right now, I know I told you 225, we can back it up to 230 or so. That'd be great. If not, when you call in, well, then we'll go with that. And the call-in numbers are 888-627-6008 or 323-744-4831. I have a blog site, LDDJEnterprises.com, for you can see all of my writings and the books that I have on Amazon, and also have a Patreon, Jeff Dawson 59. So yeah, the winter storm was pretty bad. So what do you do when it's bad? Well, luckily where I live, I got the sun. My neighbors across the hall, they didn't get any sun. So I read some books. Well, we had the sunlight, which was great. And the two that I knocked out were Chuck Hollinger, Above the Cry of Battle. If you've never read it, I highly recommend it. It talks about his experiences as a Marine in the Philippines and how bad it was and how over time he hated the Japanese, as many of that generation did. They sent them to war and they watched their buddies die. But he was had a very strong faith, was a devout Christian, and through the years he started learning to forgive the Japanese. It wasn't easy, and he really goes through his painstaking process. Another one was Richard Bach's Illusions. That was given to me by a good friend, and it's a short read, only took, I don't know, half a day, three quarters of a day, no big deal. That's a good one. That's a very good book. It gives you a different perspective on what's going on. To everyone. Ooh, I probably ought to turn my chat on. Okay. I see Mr. Smith is calling in.
Yes.
Mr. Robert?
Hi, Jeff. How are you today?
I'm good. I hadn't gotten to the introduction yet because I had technical difficulties for about 15 minutes. So since
That's
you're
okay.
here,
That's okay.
let me go ahead and give your bio and we can get right into this. I'm sure you have other things to do today, correct?
I do, but this
Okay.
is going to be one of the highlights of my day.
Well, that's a scary thought because let's see, what was last time I saw you was 20 years ago, I believe, at the
It's been a
30th
long time,
reunion.
yes.
Okay, well, folks,
That's right, yes.
this is Robert Smith. We both went to high school together in German class. He is received an appointment to West Point, graduated in 82 with an engineering degree, and was commissioned as a Lieutenant of Artillery, spent 26 years, got to the full rank of colonel, has served all over Europe and the world. He is very intelligent, and that's why I've brought him on to discuss this book I mentioned earlier. He has worked for FEMA and he wound up getting a master's degree from the University of Missouri. And we have had many debates over the last months on history topics, elections, and he kept informing me that I needed to read this book by Jordan Peterson, The 12, get to my notes so I get the title right, The 12 Rules of Life, An Antidote for Chaos, of which we have seen a lot. Now, Robert, I'm very curious, why did you suggest this book to me?
Well, Jeff, can you hear me okay? First off.
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I read this book the first time a number of years ago. It's been out since the early 2000s. And I just, with the things that are going on nowadays, the many things, I went back to reread it because it had so many salient points about what the author, Dr. Peterson, calls the nature of being. Sort of, he refers to it throughout the book. It's his broad definition of sort of what it's like to be a human, the nature of being. And the reason I recommended it is because it does have, well, let me just tell you why I like the book. Every bit of it rings true for me. His 12 rules may not be my 12 rules or your 12 rules or be the same order of prioritization I would give, but I agree with his rationale for each of his 12 rules. It can be dense reading, as you found out. And he tends to overwhelm the reader with evidence and rationale for each of his rules. He draws his evidence and his rationale from a variety of disciplines, and that's what really kept me in the book. So deeply. Every one of these disciplines reveal the sort of nature of being a human, including Peterson's experience as a practicing clinical psychologist, his education and background in psychology. He was a professor at the University of Toronto. He's a Canadian. And he expounds on the different methodologies of Freud and Jung and Nietzsche and Mencken and Skinner and other famous psychologists, but he also goes to the great religions and their teachings, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Taoism. He quotes liberally from these faith traditions, as well as the great philosophers who've pondered the nature of human existence and the experience for millennia, Aristotle, Socrates, right up to Marx. And he also quotes and discusses the great masterworks of literature because they all comment on the human condition. Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Goethe, John Milton, Solzhenitsyn, Orwell, and even the Bible. And he also quotes and uses modern science, modern neurosciences, biologists like Jane Goodall, mathematicians, researchers, writers, practitioners, he has 220 endnotes at the back of his book where he's quoted these great thoughts and great thinkers. And I think his writing is revealing. I think he's witty and funny. I think he, and this is why I recommended it to you, and I will recommend it to your listeners who have not experienced this book. He buries many of the popular modern ideas that have sort of taken root in modern society. Here's a good one. There, you know, the modern idea that came out, I think, probably in the 70s or 80s, that only humans, are really guilty of attacking and killing each other for reasons other than food or survival. You know, we're the only animal species that does that sort of thing, war and so forth. And he points out that's not true. Jane Goodall, in her studies of chimpanzees, found wanton violence by tribes of chimpanzees against other chimpanzees, and not just, to establish hierarchy, a dog will attack another dog until the other dog rolls over and exposes its belly. And then typically the behavior stops, but not with chimpanzees. They kill each other brutally. So it's not a learned human behavior. It's a natural behavior. It's a hierarchical behavior. And he points that out throughout the book, talking about the part of the nature of human being is hierarchy, how we see ourselves compared to others. And again, that gets just part of the culture. And he uses so many tools to talk about that it's really fascinating. And of course, for guys like you and I who are traditionalists, it simply, it brings back to us, why we believe in things, why we understand things like hierarchy, and why they exist. And they're not something that's just a social construct of modern, man since, 1945 or, 1900 or something, which is what a lot of popular mythology would have about a number of cultures, cultural traditions and cultural beliefs that we have. That's why I like the book. That's long.
Okay. Well, that's a good synopsis. And that was probably my problem at times, was when he would start a chapter, it's like, okay, just the first one, which was Stand Up Straight. And he went into the analysis of the lobsters and how they survive. And then he started getting off, to me, it was tangents. And it's like, okay, he is a very deep thinker. There's no doubt about that, but that's why it was difficult for me at times to say, okay, now what is the point here? I understood where you started this, but it seems like we're going around a real long gate to quote from the great philosophers of those days and the great thinkers and some of the religions to support the thesis he was putting forth. Am I looking at this right?
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with your point at all. I think, the first chapter, his first rule, stand up straight with your shoulders back, is for, guys of your and my background, people of your and my background. I shouldn't say guys, but I use guys generically.
Well, I understand. No problem.
That whole first chapter is sort of a study of evolutionary psychology. And what he's doing is he's saying lobsters are 65 million years old, unchanged. Mm-hmm. 65. They're older than the dinosaurs. And yet, yes, they have these simple things, they have these simple behavioral characteristics where the top lobster goes, struts around and gets all the female lobsters and gets the best place to hide and the best area to look for food and so forth. And the reason the lobster does is that it fights for its territory and it struts. It actually walks around, and there's a certain behavioral characteristic about how a male lobster will do this. And what he's pointing out with that discussion is, when that lobster wins, when it is challenged by another male and it wins, it gets a burst of serotonin into its little tiny lobster brain.
Yes.
And that increases the strutting and the sorts of things that we see that are actually common among humans, or not uncommon, let me put it that way. And so what he's pointing out is this is nature. This is the nature of being an animal with the same chemical characteristics as a lobster, which humans are. You know, we do, you know, if you walk around with your shoulders down and your head slumped forward and so forth, you know, the old story about, you know, if criminals see this, they mark you as a target.
Yes.
But if you walk around, yeah, if you walk around, you know, with upright and with a confident posture, you're the person that's going to get the prime real estate, the easiest access to the best hunting grounds. You're going to get all the girls. It is exponentially more worthwhile to be successful if you're a lobster and male. And if you win, you win those fights, or at least you struggle on like you can. Other lobsters will simply back away if they think that you're the top lobster. Well, the same is true in a slightly different sociological sense, but it is true among humans in the very basic sense. And that's why he starts off the book with this idea, and he brings in so many different disciplines when he discusses this. And that rest of that chapter, he notes that your human brain actually keeps track subconsciously of your position in the dominance hierarchy. And therefore, this is an exceptionally ancient and fundamental part of your brain, of the human brain. It is not something that society constructed, you know, back in the 1700s, 1600s, 1500s, whatever. It has been with us since we were man-apes on the plains of the Serengeti. This is ancient human programming. It is not some construct. And this is what he dismantles sort of in his book, not intentionally, but he dismantles a lot of these modern constructs where we say, oh, this is something that, you know, modern man came up with in order to dominate women, or, you know, any of these sort of modern constructs. He goes in and says, no, if you look historically at man as a species, not men, but man as a species,
yes,
back a bazillion years, and what we're doing now, and I this is where his book really resonated with me, is what is happening now and has been happening for 100 years, is we're starting to dismantle some of these, or attempting to dismantle these things that are they're not just cultural contrivances. You know, the dominance hierarchy among humans is not a cultural contrivance. It's the reality of our existence. It's not something you're going to get rid of by teaching something different in school, but we may be able to temper the worst behaviors of people, but there's still going to be a dominance hierarchy that is part of how we deal with each other. It's part of the brain's mechanics. So
anyway, someone's always got to be in. Someone historically is going to be in charge. That's just history. Right?
Yes. Absolutely.
And you can't change that. And this brings me up to chapter 8, which when I read the book on Oppenheimer, I was really surprised at how many were card-carrying communists. And in chapter 8, I just kept shaking my head when I came across, you know, why are intellectuals so enthralled with communism? And, you know, he gives all these lists of Pol Pot and Mao and Marx and Stalin, especially Pot, Mao, and Stalin. I mean, why do these people gravitate towards communism? It just baffles my mind.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. And again, this is something that seems to have drawn a lot of academia. And of course, when you're drawing in academics, then, you know, that's what they teach their students, that communism is just another system and it would work beautifully and wonderfully and would level the playing field for everybody if it was only done right. And you think, yeah, but we're humans and humans don't do everything right.
No.
Which is why we put in checks and balances into government. And we don't allow, the totalitarian regimes. And this is one of the things that characterized Peterson's early life. He grew up in the same time frame that you and I did.
Yes.
When, you know, the Cold War was ongoing, and there was a fear of, you know, possible nuclear annihilation at any moment. And part of what convinced him, or what he was concerned with in his early college years, was why is it that mankind would threaten each other with complete obliteration of the entire race over these sort of national tribes, you know, the West on one side and the East on the other side, or the communists on one side and democracies and freedom on the other, however you want it to characterize it. And he points out that, you know, the worst mass murderers in human history, you know, going back as far as Genghis Khan, were
yes.
Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, all of these people who were, you know, trying to complete and hold power, tyrannical power, and the power of communism. You know, the power of convincing people, oh, you only have to give up all of your property and turn over anybody here that used to have property, and we'll march them off to the death camps. And, you know, he talks about what happened in early Soviet Russia that caused some of the worst famines in human history in Russia. And the same thing in the Cultural Revolution in China. Oh, we need to change all of this. We need to forget all the old cultural stuff. And we're going to go with this new culture called communism, and results in the death of, oh, I don't know, 20, 30 million. It's stunning, but that's what's not taught when communism is discussed as a simple moral. And I get it. If you're trying to discuss a political or sociological system, a system by itself, you just discuss the sort of line and block diagram. But that the line and block diagram is not actually how it operates when there are people who are affected by being, people who are affected by hierarchical needs, people that are affected by all the other things he discusses in the book. And one of the things he discusses is the immense capacity that people have for evil. And he discusses that in depth in some of the chapters, and it goes back, you know, he goes back to the Garden of Eden in that discussion. But when you have that kind of, you know, when you have people in charge of those, of all the links and levers in that system, then that system can easily be twisted to something very evil. Like he describes in depth numerous times Solzhenitsyn's experiences is written in the Gulag Archipelago. I tried reading that book, and it is just so dark. I just couldn't get through it. It is so negative. So, you know, oh my God, how can anyone live through this? And it was, you know, the gulags, the Soviet concentration camps, were designed for people to give up all hope and die, essentially, while cutting down trees and building roads in Siberia. And living in, you know, log shanties with no heat. That's describing it nicely.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but correct me if I'm wrong, since we're the same age, was there not a movie when we were, say, in 14 or 15 that came out after that movie that depicted the Russian gulags and what it was about? Because I believe it's centered around... It could have been either Soviet political prisoners, or they were some of the Germans that had been captured after Stalingrad, and what it was like to live out there. And do you remember this film?
I don't, Jeff, but I'll tell you, he discusses both of those several times throughout the book, the Nazi concentration camps and what they did to the Jews. And other Untermensch, as the Germans called it, the Nazis called it, and the Soviet concentration camps. And he doesn't touch on the current Chinese concentration camps and the treatment of the Uyghurs. But I think because it was just not well known in the time when he wrote the book.
Right.
Part of what's going on inside communist China. But, you know, he points this out in order to, in some ways, juxtapose it to democracy, and what democratic systems allow in terms of liberty and freedom. And, you know, we don't have concentration camps. We may have poorly run prison systems in some cases, but we don't have concentration camps that are designed to actually, you know, kill the prisoners. We don't have that sort of thing. And we have governments with checks and balances, and we have a free and open media that can expose, you know, the worst excesses of governments and officials and whatnot. At least that's the ideal. It's just when he discusses that sort of thing in the book, you know, you remember that's part of the capacity for evil that people have, that all people have in their hearts. Anybody, I mean, not in his estimation, but he's pointing out that you never know what evil people are capable of. And you have to watch it in yourself to make sure, you know, that when you get angry or when you get, you know, when you feel that urge, that hostility coming on, that you make sure that you react and try and balance out your behavior. I mean, if you get angry at your children, which he talks about several times,
yes,
that you're not, you know, to not take it out on them, that they are behaving, they're misbehaving, and it's disrupting something you want to do, and so it makes you angry, and that capacity for evil will start coming out in how you treat children or how you treat others. And so it's that's one of the hallmarks of the book. If we can go back for a second, you know, the title of the book is How to Deal with or An Antidote to Chaos.
Yes.
You asked me about this. Yeah, you asked me about this when we were talking about it before the show. What does he mean by his chaos theory? And because when you see that on the title, you think, okay, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. What? And it's not chaos theory like, you know, the mathematical theory or the theory of physics. It is what he describes as chaos is the opposite of order. And he points out one of the biggest the sort of central pieces of the book is that order is that state where people around you are acting according to their well understood social norms. Everybody's predictable and cooperative. It's the world of social structure. It's the world of explored territory. You know, when you get in your car and you drive to work every day, everything is sort of normal and familiar. That's the state of order. It's in, and he talks about the fact this is well known in human history, human existence, and it's representative. It's represented in religions and cultures as the masculine side. Okay, order is masculine. That's not anything to be negative about or cherish about men and negative about women. That has nothing to do with that. But it's sort of the wise king of, and the tyrant, both possible. You know, is society, is satanic. Well, anyway, chaos, the other side, is where or when something unexpected happens to disrupt the orderly, normal, you know, predictable life that you're having. Chaos emerges, you know, it can be when you have a car accident and suddenly everything stops. And now, you know, the person is filled with anxiety and maybe fear and certainly anger. Everything is disrupted. Your normal life is disrupted. It can be something very trivial, like if you're at a party and if you're with strangers at the party and you tell a joke and everybody kind of looks at you. And there's this sort of cold silence. It's like, uh-oh, you know, that's humorous. But for the person who did it, in reality, you're standing there and you're extremely embarrassed because you don't know what you said, maybe. But you're certainly taken out of that world of order and normality and familiarity, and you're suddenly in the world of chaos. Now you've got to figure out how to get back to normality, right? And you do things which maybe, you know, might be like, I'm leaving the party, whatever, to get back. To get away from that. So that's chaos is can be catastrophic. It can be, you know, when a family member falls extremely ill and it disrupts everything. It can be so many things. And so what he's saying is in his book that these 12 rules are, if you follow them, this is one way to keep chaos at bay, to increase the amount of familiarity and order and normalcy in your life. And so that these are the 12 rules for doing that. And he explains them in depth, as I was saying. I think it's a brilliant expose on this stuff. Anyway, I interrupted you by going back to the.
No, you're fine. That's why you're on here, to give perspective on this work, because I will probably have to read this again. And because, you know me, I like to get to the heart of the thing. But when I have a psychologist writing a book, it's like, okay, he's not going to get the heart the way I want him to. So now I have to follow his train of thought. And sometimes I just got to put this down because I just got overwhelmed.
Oh yeah, it is. When I was reading the book, and I've read it three times now, when I read the book, I really had to find a quiet period where there is nothing else. You can't read this like you're reading so many other things, because it's not superficial. You can't read it like when you're on the treadmill or something, reading a magazine, or you can't do that. You really have to be able to focus on what he's saying.
You have to be 100% invested in it, or you're just going to lose your mind and go, why am I doing this? Well, because you've got to, as you said, you got to clear your mind, no distractions, because you're about to get into a really deep read. That I will agree with 100%.
I would start reading this, and I would get so into it that, I would lose track of, a lot of things, like you do in a very good novel. My wife tapping me on the shoulder and saying, hey, it's been 2 hours, we're going to go do this or that, remember? That's how you can get drawn into it. And I would, if I read a paragraph and I just didn't understand it, or I got a little distracted by a noise or something and read it but didn't read it, I would go back and reread it. And it's one of the few books. There are books that you'll read that will quote other books, and there'll be, long quotations in italics. And I almost always skip over those when I see it in a book, because, in this book I didn't. So if it's a long passage from the Gulag Archipelago, or from Aristotle, or something like that, and from Dostoevsky, I'm thinking, oh my God, I didn't really want to read Dostoevsky, but I would read it and I would go, oh yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I get his point now.
Okay.
So, So what chapter do you want to talk about now? About eight.
Let's see. Well, we were on eight, and I did like this one part, which I think really applies today, where he discusses the little lie becomes a bigger one and then reality.
Yeah.
And I think with our media today, we see a whole lot of that, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, depending what you watch. How do you wade through that? Based on his teachings here, how are you able to disseminate what the truth is and what fiction is?
He really gets into the psychology of lying in there. It's interesting. He gives an example. I'm not going to go into it because it'll take too much time. But, he says, for example, if you've got someone who is sort of pestering you, and you put them off with a little white lie. Oh, I can't come to your party because of this, I've got something else planned. I can't do this with you. If there's someone who wants your company, for example, and you really don't want to spend time with them because you really don't enjoy spending time with them for whatever reason. And we'll make up little fibs. And what he says is, they're better off, you're better off if you just tell them the truth. Just tell them the truth.
I agree with that.
And you can tell them the truth if you choose your words carefully and you think about it, you can tell them the truth without stomping all over their feet. You know, you can tell them the truth in a way that it won't hurt them. But sometimes that hurting, you know, someone's feelings a little bit, you don't want to do something with somebody because you don't want to go out to a bar with a friend because they always get drunk. They always get drunk and they get loud.
Yes.
So, and even if it's a good friend, and they say, "Hey, you know, let's go out Friday night," and you try and make an excuse, "Oh, I can't. I've got these plans." And, "Well, let's go out next Friday night, or let's go out Saturday night." You know, "Well, no, I can't." Pretty soon, you run out of excuses, and you know, it's better to say, "Hey, look, Bill, you know, I just don't have a good time because when we go out, you know, you drink too much, you get loud." You know, pretty soon we're confronting other people in the bar and it's going to be a fight or, you know, something. He said, I don't want that when I go out on Friday nights to have a drink. I don't mind sitting around talking and enjoying ourselves, but I don't like, you know, that will cause them maybe to rethink their own behavior. So that's part of his point in one of his the points about telling the truth instead of lying. There are other bigger truth points as well, deeper points, but that's one of the ones that I thought was, was something that's very valuable to most people.
Well, it's completely valuable because when you start telling those little white lies, as you mentioned, they just either start running out of them or they just get bigger to the point. If you'd have just confronted them at the very first and said, "Here's the problem. Here's why we're not doing this. I'll go out with you, but I'll tell you what, you start getting drunk and I'm gone and you will be on your own." Now you think about that, because who's going to bail you out and get you out of a bad situation?
Sure.
And usually
discusses that. Go ahead.
Don't, right. You know, they'll either respond to that or not, but then you have to make the decision. Is this somebody that I want to spend my time with? Because they're not
exactly, they're
not helping me, they're not helping themselves, and I'm not going to be drugged down. And that goes back to walking with your shoulders straight up. How do you want to be envisioned by your peers and other people in public? It's like, is this a good person, or it's like, man, I don't want anything to do with that guy.
Yeah, exactly right. He also, and I think this is part of what you were getting to about this, it's not just the little lies, but it's also the big lies. And he talks, one of the themes throughout the book is that life, being, is suffering. The nature of life is suffering. We all suffer. If you're not suffering in life, the rich suffer as much as the poor. Life is suffering. You suffer in your own way, but everybody suffers. It's just, that's the nature of being. And it's part of, you know, it's part of what you learn too, how you learn. You learn through suffering. He talks about the big lie and the big lies that were told. You remember Hitler stating so clearly that in the big lie, there's a certain force of credibility. Hitler always talked about the big lie. Tell the big lie. People will believe the big lie before they believe the little lie. And so he believed there was a large scale falsehoods like that were so unbelievable that people would believe them. You see what I mean? No one's going to tell the big lie in public, the big lie, because, you know, everybody will recognize it's baloney. It's not true. But then in recognizing that, they think, well, maybe it is true. And I think that's the bedrock of a lot of conspiracy theories. That pop up all the time on the left and on the right. And I have friends that get fully invested in some of these theories, and they ask me, and I'm like, you know, I spent a lot of time in countries, not this country, but in other countries where, you know, big lies are told and there's a lot of conspiracy theories. And the internet's full of them, just full of them.
It is, yes, it is stock full.
And I lived in the Middle East, you know, for a number of years doing contract work over there.
Right.
And I have a lot of Arab friends. And I'm here to tell you, smart, intelligent, educated people who believe stuff they see on the internet that you just go, you know, you're at pains to tell them, no, the CIA did not shoot down that airliner over Ukraine. It did not happen. The CIA does not have satellites up there with big lasers or missiles that can shoot down. I mean, it's technically impossible at this time anyway, you know, to shoot down an airliner with something from a satellite. Come on. But they would not, you know, they wouldn't give it up because I saw it on the internet. And it fitted in with their pre-existing cultural beliefs about that had been, you know, established over decades and decades and decades of, you know, CIA bad, America, you know, was willing to do these things. And the Russians said the Americans shot down the, you know, this Malaysian airline. And I dealt with that stuff on a fairly frequent basis. You know, why did you Americans do this? We didn't do that. You know, that's not something we did.
But the internet said you did.
I saw it on the internet. Exactly. But, you know, Americans will believe the same sorts of things. They will also believe conspiracy theories. And I'm telling you, you know, when a friend comes to me and says, what do you think about this? I'll say, you know, most conspiracies are just fundamentally impossible because once three people know, it's going to get out. Three people cannot keep their mouths shut. So it's going to get out. It's not going to be a conspiracy that's been, you know, lurking. That's the stuff of Hollywood. And Hollywood preys on and uses those fantasies, you know, in the imagination to produce blockbuster films. You know, the couple of movies that, I can't remember what his name is. Nicolas Cage has been in, you know, National Treasure. You know, that kind of conspiracy theory, you know, splashed over the big screen. Everybody's like, oh, you know, the big, you know, all this gold hidden way under a church in Boston where the water table is about 30 feet.
You know,
sure, there's this big chamber that goes down hundreds and hundreds. Now, come on. You know, you hate to be able to pick it apart like that. But so if you just let yourself go with the movie and it's flight of fantasy, that's fine. We're having fun. But that's not reality. That's not reality.
No, it's not.
Drawn into it.
Well, it's, you know, you could use the movie. You could use the movie Air Force One with Harrison Ford.
Right.
You know, how is that going to actually play out? And you really think this is going to happen? And all these guys are shooting on that plane and not a bullet one penetrates the fuselage. How did that not happen? It's Hollywood. It's an illusion. It's make believe. Take it for what it is. It's not the truth. Okay. I'm sure all the Japanese thought the Godzilla movies were real too.
Well, that I don't know about, but because that's even further out the flight of fantasy branch. But the thing is that the more of these movies that are so realistic that Hollywood produces, like Mission Impossible series, when I was in Iraq, kids would ask us. We wore special sunglasses that were issued that were ballistic. Ballistic protection sunglasses. So they would protect your eyes against small fragmentation that penetrate normal sunglasses. So if you were inside a vehicle that got hit by an RPG or rocket propelled grenade, and the inside armor on that vehicle splashed out, what's called spalling, all these micro grains of steel, they can blind you. It will penetrate, you know, it'll penetrate your face and so forth, but it won't kill you typically. Spalling doesn't always kill. And we have protection mechanisms to get that, but it can blind you. So we would wear these sunglasses. They were Wiley X sunglasses. But because they looked unusual and we were all wearing them, kids would ask us, are those the special X-ray sunglasses where you can see through women's clothes?
What? Yeah, what? Didn't we see those in our comic books when we were in our early teens?
Yeah, exactly. But they believed it. And there were men, grown men, who believed this. And so we would have to walk up and pull off the sunglasses and let the kids look through them and let the men look through them. They looked through them and they say, no, the other sunglasses. No, we don't have other sunglasses. This is it. This is what these are. they are just sunglasses. But they're so convinced that America has, because of Hollywood, America has all these technologies, that it becomes easier and easier to believe the crap you see on the internet about shooting down an airliner, you know, the CIA shooting down an airliner from outer space, you know, and believing that we have X-ray sunglasses. Because Hollywood invents this stuff, and they put it on like Mission Impossible, where you have all these special tools that don't actually exist, or some exist in somebody's fevered brain. But, you know, these are the sort of fantasies that end up becoming part of the lie that we deal with on a daily basis. And I think part of what his lesson here is in the book is that as rational human beings, we should understand, we should believe that even though people have a capacity and political parties have a capacity for, you know, thieving and lying and, you know, all of that sort of thing, we should start off with, and I've tried to run my life this way, start off with believing first the good before immediately assuming the bad. So, you know, I typically assume that when one political party or the other is doing something that, or a politician is doing something, there may be underlying motivations. But I try to first believe that they're doing something that they actually believe in will be good for their constituents or good for something. It's not all just a bunch of evil stuff. And I watched, you know, the last 4 years as the media got more and more into impugning every single motivation of the Trump administration and the Republican Party, and then all the voters that voted for Trump it made it even more ingrained in my, you know, in my belief system that you can't do that. We have to try and first believe that whatever they were doing was based on their own beliefs about what is good for America or their constituents or whatever. They may be incorrect. And I hate the constant use of the word lie, too. We're getting off the trail of the book, although we're back to lies. But we fling that word around now on Facebook and on television, and it's lost the power that it used to have. I mean, lying is not the same thing as saying something that's incorrect, that's factually inaccurate. If you believe something is this and you state it, that doesn't mean you're lying. If you believe it, you're not lying. You just happen to believe something that may be incorrect, that may be inaccurate. You may believe 2 + 3 = 6 when it's actually 2 × 3 = 6. Okay, that doesn't mean you're lying when you say, no, 2 + 3 = 6. You're not lying. You believe that. You know, you're not maliciously trying to convince others of something that is untrue. That's what lying is. So, but you know, oh, this guy's lying. That person's lying. This person's lying. Really? Are they out there trying to convince you of something they know is untrue? Or are they trying to convince you of something they believe? If they're trying to convince you of something they believe, that's not lying.
And
that is being, them trying to persuade you.
Yeah, being in construction, I can definitely agree with your line of thought there, because we would have many meetings and debates where this isn't going to work. We're not saying you're lying. We're just saying this isn't going to work. Now,
right,
we've got to figure out a solution to the problem and move forward. But if we're going to sit there and say, well, you're lying, I'm not lying about anything. I'm stating the facts. This is what you designed. This is how it's supposed to be installed. It's not going to work. How do we fix this mm-hmm. problem? And I don't see enough exactly. of that in Facebook or any other of the social medias. It's not so... How are we going to fix this? No, it's just, you're just dead wrong. Well, why am I wrong? Well, because you're wrong. Well, you haven't told me why I'm wrong. I just want to understand what's the problem here, and can we move forward, or is there just no reconciliation available on this topic? I don't know. But I'm not just going to say, because I don't agree with you, that, well, you're just lying. No, that's taking the cheap way out, and... At times, to me, it's like, so why are you just being ignorant on the topic? I'm not trying to call you out. I'm saying, these are the facts I have. What are your facts? Okay. Do they mesh? Do they not?
Sure.
Where are we at? And
you know, there's a great rule from Peterson's book, rule nine, that is, assume that the person you are listening to might know something you don't. You know,
yes.
So it's a chapter on listening, on how to listen and try to understand what they believe and why they believe it. And you might actually you might find it compelling. You might change your mind, or at least part of your views. If an expert is speaking, you know, or if you have two competing experts speaking, which we have a lot of nowadays with, you know, discussions about COVID, you know, you've got to listen carefully to what they're saying and to make judgments. But, you know, you should always assume the scenario you described is right on about this. You are the expert in construction engineering based on your experience. And you are trying to tell a client, this is how we have to do it. If you don't do it this way, this, and this may happen. And if those happen, you know, the structure will collapse, or this will fail, or, you know, these are from my experience and my education, what might happen. It might not happen, but it is much more likely to happen if you don't use, you were talking about, I think, pre-stressed concrete on one of your shows a couple of weeks ago. And talking about the structural differences between, you know, concrete that's used in some applications versus concrete that's used in other applications. And there's different strengths to the concrete. See, I'm falling way back on my old engineering degree here.
That's anyway, okay.
And I haven't used it much in the last 40 years, I can assure you. But it does help me understand science. So, you know, it's not that the facts are not different. One person's not lying. You're not lying to the client. You're just saying that concrete that you're considering using, the aggregate is not as good, or for whatever reason, in my experience, it's not going to satisfy your requirements. It's not going to be strong enough to support this structure or whatever. So you're not lying. You are giving him. Now, he may actually know something, or you may be discussing this with a different construction engineer who knows about a new technique that you had not heard of yet, or something. Who knows? So, you know, if it's another construction engineer, you give them your time, you listen to them, and you say, wow, I hadn't thought about that. We might try that if we have the time and, you know, can cost it out and so forth. So, you know, the point of all of this is, go ahead.
No, well, that's why I didn't have any questions on that particular chapter, because be precise in your speech is that, I mean, or the other one on assume the person you're listening to might know something. I learned a long time ago, if you don't take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, you're not going to learn anything. And you'll just continually make the same mistakes. So you've got to, I've sat through many meetings where I said nothing until the very end. And then they'd say, well, what do you think? And it's like, you really want me to answer that question? Now that I've listened to everyone's opposing views, the good, the bad, and the ugly, now you want me to throw in my two cents? And they go, yeah. And usually they didn't like it, but it's like, here's the summation of everything we've talked about, and we still haven't addressed the problem. So this is how I think we need to address the problem, and throw it on the table and move on. But yeah, you got to learn to listen.
Yeah.
Okay.
True.
I got,
go ahead.
I got a question for you. I want to jump ahead to chapter 12, because I found this a really interesting statement, the chapter Pet a Cat When You Encounter One on the Street. And do you agree with this statement? We love someone not for the limitations, but because of them.
I think that there's a lot of truth in that statement. I thought it's a very striking and I think profound statement. You don't love someone. You love someone for the wholeness of their personality and who they are. There are some things that, you know, that the people we love, whether it's children, children or spouses or other family, they all have, we all have, you know, little quirks and whatnot that other people find irritating. And you know, but we still love them. You know, my wife has quirks that I find irritating sometimes, and she has quirks, or I have quirks I'm sure that she finds irritating, although she tells me I'm perfect all the time. So
I'd like to get a second opinion on that.
But yeah, his point is that I think on this one is that being human, the more human you are, the more you can be loved. The less human, the more perfect you are, the harder it is. I think is where he's going with that. I was a little struck by it. There were some other things that he said in there. First of all, it's really interesting when he's talking about this, because he mostly talks about dogs, even though the chapter's about cats.
But, yeah, that was interesting too. Yes.
Yeah, he quotes a psychologist named Henry Tifel, and Tifel used to, bring people in, and what he would do in studying social organization, how people socially organize themselves, he would bring them in, sit them down, and one at a time, and flash a bunch of dots on a screen. And then he would ask people, how many dots did they see? What did they estimate? So they would estimate the numbers. And then he would break the two groups, the people into two groups, one that saw fewer, one that saw more. And he found it interesting that people would then become very tribal, even though they didn't know each other at all before the experiment. They would become very tribal and supportive of the group they'd been put in, based on the number of dots they saw on a screen. And so the point of this is that people are very social, but they're also very antisocial. And so when people get arbitrarily put into two groups and they're told, oh, the reason you're in this group is because you saw fewer dots or you saw more dots, or he would explain it, you know, slightly more, you know, a different way, they would become, they would feel they were part of this team or the other team, and then they would be competing in their ideas and their thoughts and what they saw and everything. So they would become antisocial to each other, although they were socially cohesive within their groups, which is crazy. But it points out why, you know, when we've got so much discussion about, you know, relations between ethnic groups and races and socioeconomic groups, it's not just about, you know, people's skin color or people's economic status. This sort of grouping, this tribalism, is something that is intrinsic to human behavior. It is not intrinsic just to white behavior or to black behavior or to, you know, whatever. It is intrinsic to human behavior. And if people are from a different tribe, even if you're two African tribes in Africa and you're fighting, or you're two Native American tribes in Native America, you were fighting, you were competing. You were competing for land, you were competing for you know, horses. I mean, you know, the greatest competitors, well, I shouldn't say that. Some of the greatest competitors on the North American continent were the Comanche Indians.
Yes, they were. My God. They were bad. There wasn't anything nice about them. They hated everybody that wasn't associated with them.
They did, but you know, they were really unique because their culture, because they lived literally once they discovered horses and became a horse centric culture. Because originally they were a mountain tribe, sort of like the Utes, and they were on foot until, you know, the Spanish brought the horses in, and, you know, the rest is history.
But yes,
their culture was around horses, and because they lived in the saddle, their level of miscarriage among the females, the pregnant females, was very high, and the mortality rate was extremely high. I think I read it was 70 or 80%.
Really?
And so what that led to the habit of raiding other Indian tribes, Spanish settlers, Mexican settlers, American settlers, you know, and everybody else they could, to steal young people and women so they could continue to expand their tribe. So they didn't care what your background was. They didn't care what your ethnicity was. Once you were in the tribe long enough, you were Comanche. And the perfect example of that was the Parker, Cynthia Parker, Cindy Parker, who was kidnapped from the Parker Ranch. The movie, John Wayne movie, The Searchers, was based on this story. And it's really brought to life in S.C. Gwynne's book, The Empire of the Summer Moon, about the Comanches. Wow, what a book. She was kidnapped, taken away. A lot of the women and children were taken away. And she became, literally, even though she came from a white Caucasian, you know, ethnic group, she became completely Comanche, culturally. And once she was taken back, years and years later, she kept wanting to go back to the Comanche. She was extremely unhappy being stuck in a white settlement, you know. And so the point here is that tribal groupings are often very superficially based. You know, the idea that, you know, skin color, I love the way some commentators point out, it's like of all the most trivial things that we should base merit-based systems on, skin color is one of the most trivial. You wouldn't pick your surgeon based on skin color. You'd pick your surgeon, you know, if you're going to have heart surgery or brain surgery or any kind of surgery, you pick your surgeon based on, you know, recommendations, reviews, where they went to school, what they, you know, all the things that are describe that individual's competence at being a surgeon or being a airplane pilot or being a plumber. You don't care what color they are, what ethnicity they are. I don't. I don't think anyone does. Not really.
Are you capable of doing the job? That's all I need to know.
Exactly. And in my current job, I won't go into it, but when I hire people, I don't care. I don't care what your color, ethnicity, or gender are. I need to know that you can do the job. That's all I want to know. Can you do the job? Can you show up on time? Can you do the work? That's what I want to know. And if you do it really well, you'll get promoted. You'll get raises.
Yeah.
You know,
that's my
background of being in the Army. You know, the Army was, it is not completely 100% meritorious. There are individuals who get promoted, you know, because they worked for, you know, a certain well-known individual or someone else signed an evaluation report. Everybody goes, oh, that evaluation report was signed by the future chief of staff of the Army or whatever. And so they automatically, you know, so that does happen. It is generally very meritorious in its selection process it's generally meritorious. And so that's the system I sort of grew up in. And I can't fathom any other way of, you know, evaluating, you know, people based on, you know, for a work environment, you evaluate them based on their performance, period. So anyway, now we're getting way off the beaten path here. I love the way he describes that. And we're going to go back to, that was the group, the people are social versus antisocial in groups. And how people deeply, and it's something that goes back to our earliest nature, you know, again, when we were sort of man-apes wandering around on the plains of the Serengeti, people organize themselves. We have a natural tendency to organize ourselves for protection from the elements and from, you know, other, you know, predators. And within that organization, we automatically form dominance hierarchies. We do it automatically. You know, there's always going to be someone who's going to be the leader, as you said earlier.
Yes.
The elected chief, and they will be probably, you know, in the, you know, the early caveman days, it would be someone who can, you know, who can provide, who can think, who's strong, who's fast, whatever, and those would be the initial characteristics. Later in history, it was someone who could imagine how to keep the tribe alive better. When do we need to move? When do we need to migrate? You know, all these sorts of things, you know, beget the leader. And so this is part of our, you know, cooperation in terms of banding together as a social group, and competition in terms of growth and status and that hierarchy are two fundamental characteristics of human behavior, not, again, not white behavior, not black behavior, not Asian behavior, not, you know, it's human behavior.
Yes.
And, you know, you can't educate this out of people.
You can try, but when they realize what's going on, eventually there will be pushback and it won't be well received.
And why do we like competitive sports so much? Because of this. We enjoy seeing the competition. We enjoy watching athletes compete, because it is that is sort of one of those higher forms of, it's not entertainment. It is us looking at observing the perfection or near perfection, or, you know, of those basic characteristics of competition that define, you know, success, and you know, from the earliest days of man. So it's something that is, again, wired to watch a great game of football or a great game of basketball or baseball, or, you know, me, I was a wrestler in high school. And so the you know, those sorts of fundamental competitions are something that we, for the most part, really, really enjoy. Now, not everybody enjoys sports. A lot of people don't. But, you know, again, it's a fundamental thing. It's that competition that we enjoy seeing, because it strikes a chord deep within our psyches somewhere.
Well, you know, whether it's, you know, checkers, dominoes, or chess match, you know, for those that aren't physically active, sure, they really get into that. Well, that's competition. And
that's a great point.
You know,
yeah, it's not just physical competition. It's all,
no, it's exactly. You know, you have to throw mental competition in there too. So it's what we do. It's what history has said we've done. Well, Robert, I got to get close to wrapping this up. I really appreciate you coming on and giving me and the listeners a much better insight into this book of Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules of Life, An Antidote for Chaos. It's, as you said, I'm glad you said you'd read it three times, so I didn't feel like an absolute idiot going, well, I've read it once and I still don't understand it all. Now I've got support in going back and rereading it to flesh out some of the finer points and obtain some more understanding to this fine work.
Yeah, it's I the more you read it, the more it speaks to you about things that are so fundamental to human culture and human awareness and that sort of thing. And it is so on point right now for what we're going through as a nation, and you know, as a society, a larger human society. And I guess it's probably been on point, you know, for decades, if not longer, because these are tried and true, you know, rules that he's come up with. And, you know, we really didn't get that deeply into the book. And if you want to discuss it again, different parts of it or whatever, I'd love to come back on the show.
It'll be my pleasure to have you after I've been able to read some more. And I did have some other questions, but the show is only an hour, but I mean, we could spend an hour just on each one of these chapters at times.
Yeah, we could. You really could.
But at least we scratched the surface.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. Well, you and your wife enjoy the rest of the weekend.
You as well, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, and I will definitely see you on Facebook on occasion.
And if not there, the next reunion, whenever that is.
They'll probably be a 45th.
That would be,
because they've been doing, we had
really revealing our age here.
Well, you know, okay, so I'm 61, you know. I don't make any bones about it, but yeah, they had we had the 10th, the 20th, and then they had the 30th. Then they had a 35th for, so yeah, I believe we'll have a 45th. Just because it'll give,
looking forward to that. It'll be fun.
It gives people something to do and get out of the house.
Yeah. And, we need to, next time I'm in Dallas, I'll give you a ring and maybe we can share an adult beverage and talk about old times back in.
That sounds like a great plan, sir.
I look forward to it.
All righty. You have a good weekend and I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye-bye.
You bet. Well, I hope you enjoyed Robert's perspective on this book. I know I did. I learned a lot. Like I said, I've read it once, and it is just, for a book that's only 12 chapters long, it is just packed with theories and information and footnotes and supporting theses. So, yeah, you just can't, unless you've just got an IQ of, say, 160, 180 or something, to be able to absorb all of the material that he is covering, I'm not even close. I'm sure there's probably 1% that could do it. Now, since we did have technical difficulties, you know, I usually do a little bit on sports. But Robert called in, and I didn't want him to wait any longer, so we took that. So where are we at in the world of sports? We do have good news, even after this horrendous winter storm. Spring training started this week. All teams reported on the 16th and 17th, and as of right now, opening day is going to be the last day of March or the 1st of April across the United States. I have not seen anything that says the MLB is going to play in a bubble like the NHL and the NBA did. As of right now, from everything I've seen, they're going to open these stadiums up across the country. Now, my fingers are crossed, but depending how this political situation goes with COVID and what different governors think is appropriate, it's hard to say how this is going to work out. But if you do want to see the trend of the cases versus mortalities, then, as I mentioned earlier, go to LDDJEnterprises.com and I post my weekly update. And right now the cases are plummeting each week. The mortalities are still going up, but if they don't start leveling off in like the next week or so, then we have been fed some really bad information, because the statistic says as one drops, and I mean, these are dramatic increases to 300, 400,000 cases a week that are, that it's dropping, new cases being seen. It is dropping. Last week, I believe, was a drop of 220 or 250,000, but the mortalities were still going up, which, okay, that makes sense. But we should start seeing this leveling out. And I did catch, and I forgot which news show it was the other day. It was MSNBC or one of them. And they had some guy on there. I think he was an MD that, oh, we haven't seen the worst yet. You just wait until March or April. Well, if you keep saying it's going to get worse, then it's easy to manipulate numbers to make it get worse. And I think that's where we're starting to come into, is there has been questions. If you saw the CDC report over the summer that said the COVID deaths, only 10,000 were from the actual virus. The CDC put this out, not me. This came from the CDC, and I had to wade through that report, and then I found it because people were posting it, and I didn't believe it until I saw for myself. All the other mortalities, every patient had underlying health conditions or multiple underlying conditions. So I don't know if we're ever really going to know the true numbers behind this. I'm been questioning this since day one, but I didn't mean to get off track. Baseball is going to be back. Now the minors, that's another story. They are still to be determined. They aren't reporting, so we don't know what's going to happen with minor league baseball, especially since they were talking about a major reorganization of the minor leagues going into the 2020 season. And what it came down to is 30% of minor league teams were going to be eliminated because they just weren't generating any income. And the home team was complaining about it sucking them dry, and they were going to consolidate a lot of teams in areas that did have good attendance and were paying their way. You know, you can look at this. If you're a purist, you're not going to be happy. If you're a realist, you're going to see the economic advantage for a club making money and drawing more than 500 and 1,000 people, which, you know, you get down to the A games, it's really hard to get folks to come and watch those. And somebody's got to pay for it because everybody's getting paid. Well, if the team can't support itself, then the home team's got to pitch in and help them out. And there will be upgrades. The MLB has said they will assist in upgrading some of the stadiums. It was an interesting concept when I read it in 2019, how they were going to approach this. But we don't know if or when these teams are going to fire up, because we have two in Dallas. We have the Grand Prairie Hogs, I think, and we got the Frisco Rough Riders. Now, the Grand Prairie Hogs, they have nothing to do with the MLB. They actually are an outlet for the Japanese leagues. I was really shocked when I heard about that, but then I looked up the roster and said, yep, that's not affiliated with the MLB, but still baseball, which Frisco, the Rough Riders are the Double-A team for the Texas Rangers, of which I don't see a lot of hope right now. We don't have a starting pitching staff. Got rid of Lennon Minor. They got rid of Elvis and brought Chris Davis in. Elvis is a year younger, was making less money. Davis is a year older, making more money. This is a good rebuilding program. No. Not at all. Okay. Let's see. I really did enjoy talking with Robert. We talk on Facebook a lot. Doesn't mean we agree with everything that each one of us says. We are conservative to a degree, but we do have spirited debates and discussions, which that's healthy. And I've said it all along. If you can't have an open debate with someone that supports your candidate, you just can't agree with everything the candidate does. I just never see it on the left. I never see any debates other than, you know, and I was going to mention this earlier before Robert came on. Yes, Rush Limbaugh died. And what was he an icon for conservative talk radio? Well, up until then, I'd never heard of conservative talk radio. So, yes, if you want to say he was a trailblazer, he was a trailblazer. And he set the stage for a lot of like guys like Glenn Beck, Hannity. They did open the door because networks saw there's big money in this. So why shouldn't we get a piece of it? Alex Jones, that's another story. But, you know, Rush passed. Okay. Was I a big fan of him? No. I really stopped listening to him religiously in 1994. After he said the Republicans, when they took the House, were going to do all this stuff in 100 days, and the Republicans didn't do a damn thing. And as far as I was concerned, instead of him calling them out, which is what I want him to do, he really didn't. And it's like, so if you won't call these people out, then what's the point? And quit giving the Clintons all this free publicity. I mean, he made a career of bashing the Clintons. Well, as far as I was concerned, that backfired because he kept making them relevant. If he'd have just let the Clintons go, maybe they'd have just disappeared into the night. and become an asterisk in the world of politics. No. He hammered on them constantly. And I was like, if you would just shut up, maybe they'd go away. But for the conservative movement, you have to give the devil his due. He was a lightning rod. Controversial? Yeah. What was the liberal site? It wasn't Air America. That was or it could have been. I mean, the Air America I think of is the CIA's Air Force during Vietnam. But the liberals tried one. And I think Al Franken was part of it. And it was a miserable failure because all they did was use profanity and destroy, and just, it was just horrible. You listen to it like 5 minutes. And it's like, well, what's your point? I mean, what are you supporting? Well, we just hate what they're doing. Okay, well, that's not going to get you very far, and it didn't. And I believe that covers everything today. I do apologize for the earlier technical difficulties, and we won't have that happen again. I look forward to having Robert Smith back on again in, say, a month or so. But I'm so glad the sun is out and it is warm in Dallas, Texas, because the last Monday through Wednesday, as many of you have endured, has been absolutely horrible. If you watch any movies where they put the prisoners and cellars in the cooler, well, that's what we have been enduring starting Sunday morning into Wednesday night. Stay safe and warm, and I will talk to you in 2 weeks. I hope you enjoyed our time together. I know I did. Without you wonderful listeners, this show would not be possible. If you want to know more about me and how my brain works, that's a scary thought, check out my books at Jeff Dawson on Amazon.com. Websites, LDDJ Enterprises and JeffDawsonAuthor.site for upcoming releases and teaser excerpts from past and present publications. You can also contact me at Facebook, LDDJ Enterprises Publishing, or email LDDJEnterprises@gmail.com or on Twitter at JeffDawson59. Have a great week and look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Dawson's Domain. I hope you enjoyed our time together. I know I did. Without you wonderful listeners, this show would not be possible. If you want to know more about me and how my brain works, that's a scary thought, check out my books at Jeff Dawson on Amazon.com. Websites, LDDJ Enterprises, and JeffDawsonAuthor.site for upcoming releases and teaser excerpts from past and present publications. You can also contact me at Facebook, LDDJ Enterprises Publishing, or email LDDJEnterprises@gmail.com or on Twitter at JeffDawson59. Have a great week and look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Dawson's Domain.